because he just started laughing. "This fucking kid," he says. Then he called his partner, Tony. "Hey, do it again, Rich. Put the gun away and do it again. Say, stick him up. You fucking kid, I like you. Fucking stick him up. Hey, Tony, was you scared?" It got worse in Pittsburgh, where I met a singer. She liked me a lot. Why, I don't know. But it was nice. Except I didn't know enough to keep my mouth shut. Thinking I was a big shot, I told people we were going out and that she was giving me money and shit. Someone told her and she came looking for me, seeking revenge. At the confrontation backstage, I thought she was going to do serious damage to me, so I beat her ass first. I didn't think about hitting a woman as much as I thought about my own survival. But shit. Pittsburgh was like a small town. Her father knew some cops, and one night as I was about to go to sleep, they busted in the rooming house where I lived, fixing to turn me inside out. Once they saw me, though, all 150 pounds of skin and bones and no muscle, they must have felt as if she should have taken me, or that at least it was a fair fight. Instead of beating me up, they let me get dressed, and we shot the shit as they took me to jail. Still, it wasn't a good situation. Skinny black kid, broke, in jail. My lawyer told me to keep quiet in court. I tried, but...
90 days, the judge said.
Shit. I remembered what Uncle Dickie had said about going to jail, which was, don't. I also remembered that Spinks, the player from Peoria who helped me lose my virginity, had always sworn he wasn't going to ever go to jail. When they finally sent him off, he stayed true to his word by dropping dead of a heart attack as soon as he heard the clink of his cell door being shut. But it wasn't so bad. In jail, I met a guy on his way out who knew my Aunt Maxine. Through him, I got her to send me $20, which I used to play the numbers. I put a dime on 313, and it came up. I won $70, and after doing 35 days... I used my winnings to buy myself out of the pokey. It was freezing the day I got out of jail. On my way back to the club, I heard Sammy Davis Jr. had performed the night before and was still in town. For some reason, I decided that I had to meet Sammy, who would become a friend years later. So I walked to his hotel, found out his room, and sat in a chair at the end of the hall. Just sat there. For hours, nothing happened. Every now and then, a policeman shuffled through and gave me the once-over, but in my suit, I appeared to be part of Sammy's entourage, or at least someone who had reason to be there. A few times, Sammy peeked out his door and saw me. Once, one of his guys brought me a plate of food, which I devoured. He probably figured I was some bum hoping for a handout, but in all honesty, I think I just wanted to shake his hand and hope some luck rubbed off on me. The next day, Sammy finally came out of the room. I stood up, grinned like a fool with nothing to say. But it was Sammy Davis Jr.
"What's happening?" he said.
"Well, I was working in town," I stammered, "and I thought I'd see you and maybe get a job with you or something." Sammy nodded. He let me bum a cigarette and gave me a bit of hope. He was so jive. He had the walk, the talk, the attitude. Didn't mind being a star one bit. It was a beautiful thing to see. Made me envious. From there, I went to Buffalo, where I met Donnie Simpson, a struggling comic like myself, though he talked more shit than anybody I knew, including me. He dragged me to Windsor, Canada, and then to Toronto, always promising we'd meet more beautiful women and earn bigger paychecks. Finally, up in Toronto, we ran out of clubs. It was 1963. I remember opening a copy of Newsweek magazine and seeing an article on Bill Cosby. It devastated me. I told Donnie and later reiterated to others, "God damn it. This nigga's doing what I'm fixing to do." I want to be the only nigger. Ain't no room for two niggers. Then why is your ass here, Rich? He said. You got to go to New York. That's where all them bit cats are.
11.
I looked as good as I could be when I arrived in New York. I wore a ragamuffin suit, a pencil-thin tie, and patent leather shoes. Although I had only $10 in my pocket, I looked like $50. At the train station, I paid 50 cents to shower, slapped on some canoe cologne, walked outside, and breathed in Manhattan. Skyscrapers, taxis, crowds racing along the sidewalks. It was a lot to take in for someone with no place to go. I heard alarms go off in my head and wondered what the hell I'd done. The only place I knew in Manhattan was the Apollo Theater in Harlem. I caught a bus uptown, got off at 125th Street, and wandered around. I didn't know a soul, but seeing all those black people made me feel better. At the Apollo, I met the guy who was in charge of booking acts. He looked and sounded like someone who'd seen and heard everything. I was just waiting till sometime later. I'd like to work here, I said. I'm a comedian. Yeah, right, he answered. Why don't you try down at the Village? This was my first time in New York, and perhaps I was dumber than dog shit, but wasn't this a city? A big city? Why was he talking about a village? He gestured. Downtown, he said. I caught a bus and sat down next to a guy who listened to me ramble about how I'd come to town to be a comedian and didn't know anyone. I told him I planned to stay at the YMCA nearest the clubs and asked if he knew where that was. He insisted that I stay with him at his rooming house on 36th Street. The guy was gay, which scared me, but he turned out to be nice and helpful. He introduced me to the landlady, got me a room, and then gave me a talk on who was naughty and nice in the area. In 1963, the Village was alive, full of cats similar to me. A bunch of hobos looking for work. I met talented young comics like J.J. Barry, Martin Harvey Freeberg, and Ron Carey. They educated me about the club scene. Someone told me to introduce myself to Manny Roth, the owner of Café Wa. And before long, I was opening for Superman Victor Brady and his Trinidadian steel band, telling jokes such as, I watch a lot of television, so I see those commercials, like the one where the woman says, Honey, I got a giant in my washer. And her husband says, Yeah? Well, he better be gone before I get home. Once I decided I was going to be in New York for a while, I took a small apartment on 14th Street. It was a strange place. You could lock the door, but any key opened it. One night, a thief broke in just after I'd gone to bed. I heard the door open. Then somebody walked in. He began rummaging through my stuff when he felt the burn of my gaze like a flashlight beam and turned around. I think you've got the wrong room, I said calmly. The dude played it just as cool and said, I guess you're right, and then left. He wasn't the only strange character I met. No, not in New York. Once I was in a restaurant with a group of people, including a beautiful lady who flirted with me. She was white, and her advances really upset the guy next to me. As soon as I picked up on this, I added grease to the frying pan, suggesting that she change seats so she could sit beside me. A few minutes later, we left for a nearby hotel. But then the joke turned on me. As we sat on the bed in the hotel room, I put my arm around her and started rubbing her sumptuous body. We worked up to that magic point, and just as I was about to ask her to give me head, my hand touched her arm. It was like no other arm that I'd ever felt. In fact, it was wooden. I checked it out with my fingernail. Hard as a tree. Could have used the motherfucker for kindling. Right away, my dick said, Adios,
retreating into my stomach, and I guess she sensed my discovery.
"Does that bother you?"
she asked.
"No,"
I squeaked, "but it scares the hell out of my dick." Before long, I became a regular at the Bitter End, the Living Room, Papa Hood's, and all the other clubs. The scene reminded me of Harold's and Collins Corner back in Peoria, but instead of Sonny Stinson, the performers were Bob Dylan, Richie Havens, and Bill Cosby. I met George Carlin at the Café Argogo and introduced myself to Woody Allen at the Bitter End. Woody said, "Stick around, watch me, and you'll learn something." But oddly, I learned more from a hooker in Baltimore. I was working the Playboy Club when I met her, and after the show she took me to her place and said, "I want you to hear something." Then she put on a green-colored record album, something that I'd never seen.
"What's that?"
I asked.
"Listen,"
she said. Then I heard Lenny Bruce for the first time. Lima, Ohio. I'd never heard anything like him before, especially his bit about the kid who went to the hobby shop to buy some airplane glue but was afraid to ask for it. Instead, he asked for everything else, all sort of crap, one item after another. Finally, after he'd gotten everything else, he blurted out that he also wanted something like 2,000 tubes of glue. That destroyed me. I went fucking crazy. One night at the Wuh, I got off stage just as a guy ran in all excited because Lenny Bruce was outside taking pictures.
"Lenny!
My God!" I raced outside to see the brightest and bravest of all. Outside, I saw a crowd gathered around a mounted policeman and his horse, this big brown thing that had crapped in the street. And through the mass of laughing people, I spotted Lenny. Scuttling about, he held a camera and, as near as I could tell, was snapping pictures of the horse's dick. That was strange, you know. Unfortunately, that's as close as I ever came to seeing him perform. Bill Cosby was the guy who was most envied. I remember seeing a picture of Bill on the cover of Time magazine. Every comedian I knew had seen it and was jealous as an ugly whore. Damn, Bill was good. Once when I played the Wuh, I heard Bill was at the Cellar, so between sets I went over to see his work for myself.
"Noah? Who's that?"
"God."
"Yeah, right."
The man was amazing. Truly amazing. Do you hear me? I was amazed. On my way back to the Wuh, I decided that's who I was going to be from then on. Bill Cosby. Richard Cosby. I grabbed the crook. It was the wrong move. He threw me down. I got up again. He knocked me down. I got up. He kicked me down. I got up. He said, "Get up." I said, "Ha-ha." Then my wife threw him across the furniture. She slapped me. The police came. She beat them up. They took her away. Me and the crook living happily ever after. If the material wasn't exactly Bill's, the delivery was, so much so that I should have informed people. But the other comics caught on and asked, "What the fuck happened?" I said, "I'm going for the bucks." I finally met Bill Cosby at Papa Hood's. There was no doubt in anyone's mind he was on his way. Like a fucking rocket ship, Cosby was going to the top. You could have put every dollar you had on that number. But he was still nice to me. He advised me to find my own thing. Then one day I told Bill that I was booked at the Apollo, my first big show there. "I'm opening for Billy Eckstein," I said. "My name's even on the marquee." I convinced Bill to jump in a cab and go uptown with me so I could show him my name on the Apollo's marquee. On the way, he told me to be careful, not to cuss, not to talk foul, not to act no fool. "But I'm being paid to be a fool," I said. "You know what I mean," he replied. At West 125th Street, The cab pulled up in front of the legendary theater. Bill and I got out and stared at the marquee. Billy Eckstein and opening acts. Bill scratched his head and looked at me, puzzled.
"Where's your name, Rich?"
he asked. "I see Billy Eckstein's, but not yours."
"Right there," I said, pointing. "Underneath."
"I don't see it."
"What do you mean, right there?"
"Opening acts." "That isn't your name."
"But it's me," I insisted. "I'm one of the opening acts."
On August 31st, 1964, I made my TV debut on Rudy Vallee's summer variety show on Broadway Tonight. Rudy himself, over his producer's objections, insisted on putting me on the show. I considered it a stroke of luck, my first opportunity at nationwide exposure. Back then, Cosby, Dick Gregory, and Nipsey Russell were among the few black comics who appeared on TV. I was happy to join them. Nervous and stiff as I stared into the camera, I began my set with an introduction. "I'm going to tell you folks a few things about myself, because a lot of you probably don't know me," I said. "I'm not a New Yorker. My home is Peoria, Illinois. I had a wild neighborhood, I gotta tell you, because my mother's Puerto Rican, my father's a Negro, and we lived in a big Jewish tenement building in an Italian neighborhood. So every time I went outside, they'd yell, 'Get him! He's all of them!'" I continued, "When I was young, I used to think my people didn't like me, because they used to send me to the store for bread, and then they'd move." After the show, my family called to congratulate me. My dad, in particular, was tickled. He said, "We're proud of you, son. At least you aren't sticking nobody up." 12. By the mid-1960s, my reputation as a comic had spread beyond the downtown nightclubs, where I was as well known for acting strange as I was for getting laughs, thanks to appearances on television variety shows like Merv Griffin and the Kraft Music Hall, I entered the mainstream. My personal life remained less conventional. I caught women as if they were taxis. But you know how sometimes you'll get a driver who's strange? That happened to me when I became involved with Tia Maria, a prostitute. She took me back to her apartment, introduced me to cocaine, her friend, the white lady.
"Come on. Everybody's doing it," she said.
"Okay. I'll try some." I started snorting like tiny pinches, saying, "I know I ain't gonna get hooked. Not on coke. My friends have been snorting 15 years and they aren't hooked." She set out nice little piles the size of small pearls. Real pretty. And I liked it. Yes, I did. From the first snort, it made me feel cool, got me brave. I started snorting little teeny things. Didn't even make any noise. Folk etiquette, Jack.
"Pass the album, please."
"Oh, no more for me."
6 months later, oink, snarf, licking the album, trying to get a freeze.
Tia Maria was nice for a liar. We would be laying in bed, and she suddenly announced that I had to leave. Immediately.
"Why, baby?"
"My uncle is coming over. I don't want him to know you're here."
She never wanted me to meet him, and for some reason I never asked why. I do as she say. I got dressed and left. Then I pleaded to come back. On it, the pussy.
"Oh, God, are you calling again? God, Richard, please, don't do this to yourself. I mean, why don't you go home and bathe or something?"
Then I heard her on the phone say,
"Just a minute, John."
One night, Tia Maria had a big party at her house. Everybody got smashed on something. I asked where she got a piece of furniture that I admired. She said it was a present from her uncle. Someone else asked his name. One of her girlfriends heard the question and chimed in,
"It came from John.
John? I asked.
You know John,
she said with a wink. Everyone laughed. Finally, I got the joke. Tia Maria had a sugar daddy. Her uncle.
You're a whore.
I'm whatever you want me to be, baby.
Tia Maria turned into a wild, crazy creature when she got high. She liked to take off all her clothes, climb out the apartment window, and walk on to the ledge of her building, with her titties blowing in the wind. She yelled at people on the street, put on one of the most exciting shows in town. Part of me enjoyed watching. You think up some weird sexual fantasies when you be on coke. You say shit like, baby, I got a great idea. I want you to get up on the roof. I'm gonna run around the house 3 times. On the 3rd time, I want you to jump off on my face. Part of me also hated it. Maybe she got off on that shit, but it scared the hell out of me. I yelled for her to get back inside, come to her senses, like I had any myself. Leave the bitch alone, a friend of mine said. But she's going to jump, I said. One of these days she's going to jump. So, that's her business. After several more of those episodes, I knew our days were numbered. I couldn't take that much excitement. There were other women around, including Sonia, a friend of Tia's, who was a beautiful girl. I fucked her a few times, and then I got the guilty so bad that I confessed to Tia. She freaked out. I thought she might throw me off the damn balcony, but not because of the obvious. See, Sonia was Tia's lady. They were lesbians. I didn't know until then, and once it was in the open, my ass was the one shoved out the door. Then I met Maxine Silverman. She dated my friend Frank. One night I got a girl and the 4 of us went out on a double date. By the end of the evening, I liked Maxine better than my date. I spent the next couple days charming my way into her life. Maxine was a phenomenal chick, the cutest white girl I'd ever seen. She zoomed along in the fast lane. She knew things, sophisticated things that I'd never learned, like which forks to use at a nice restaurant and shit like that. And she grooved right along with me in treating life like a party. Somebody told me if you put coke on your dick, you could fuck all night. Shouldn't have told me. My dick had a Jones. $600 a day just to get my dick hard. We were kids. If Maxine and I had really gotten to know each other, we would have discovered we were mismatched. We had fun together, but we didn't belong as a couple. It didn't stop me from putting her on a pedestal. That's what I did with women's. Raised them high. Treated them like royalty. Until I got them up high. Once that was accomplished, I didn't care anymore, you know. But what do you say? Nothing. You just feel bad. Let that weirdness gnaw at you like termites. Hey, Rich, what's wrong? My conscience asked. Nothing. I know you lying. You can tell me. Fuck you. The trouble starts when that shit visits you. One night after several days of non-stop snorting and drinking and snorting, I succumbed to a paranoid flittamajitter. My whole life dropped in uninvited. Broke into my room like thugs collecting money. I didn't know what the hell was happening. But it scared the fuck out of me, no doubt about that. Locked in my bedroom, I saw myself being stalked by people who wanted to kill me. Family members, guys I knew, dealers, women I'd fucked and promised shit to. The women's wanted me dead most of all. I kept checking the locks on my apartment door. I had about 12 of them. I kept turning them. Click, click. I was so fucked up that I missed a booking on the Ed Sullivan Show. My agent called the next day as I was finally returning to normal and asked what happened. I have no idea, I said. I'm just lucky to be here, you know. I'll smooth it over, Rich, he said. But listen, in this business, people talk. Don't blow it. I made the next Ed Sullivan Show. Got paid something like $500, which was a lot of money then. Maxine and I walked down Fifth Avenue feeling like we owned the world. We met up with musicians Dion and Kenny Rankin. In the Village, we bought some LSD. What did I know about acid? The guy who sold it to me said it was a cool high. White dude gave me some shit. Talking about how I'm gonna be tripping. Shit, I ain't going no place without my luggage. Neither Maxine nor I had tried LSD before, so we didn't know what to expect. We started out at a rock show, but by the time that shit kicked in, we had made it back to the safety of our home. Thank God. I can't imagine what it would have been like had we stayed out, because once I started tripping, I got into a thing with our kitty. Ordinarily, me and the cat didn't have much to do with each other. We put up with each other. Hi, kitty. How you doing? Don't talk to me, asshole. I see how you treat women. Suddenly, this cat follows me around as if we were attached. As if the cat was my shadow. Real close, too close. Particularly for somebody on LSD. Wherever I went, the cat crept right beside me. Rubbing, touching, meowing. I thought the cat was fucking with me, you know? Get the fuck away. Fuck you, Rich. I swear me and that cat got into an argument. Hey, man, look at this. I can catch my hand. At one point, Maxine and I achieved a meeting of the minds, a perfect intersection of thought and awareness, something that happens only during an acid trip. Laughing hysterically, we stared deep into each other and shared a simultaneous thought. Our relationship was wrong. Then we laughed some more, and I said, "This ain't right, is it?" We should have quit right then, but we didn't. Oh, shit. I've got to get the fuck out of here. It's amazing we survived the shit that happened. One day, I gave our last $200 to some actor who wanted to fly to L.A. to audition for a movie. Over Maxine's objections, I wrote him a check. Late that night, he broke into our apartment and stormed into the bedroom holding the check.
Rich, they couldn't read your signature at the bank. You have to write me another one.
I don't have to do anything now, I said. I'm sleeping.
Rich, please, man.
Ask Maxine. He woke her up. She got pissed all over again. She stormed out of the bedroom. I got angry at her for getting angry while this actor was angry at both of us for fucking up his big chance. Maxine ran onto the balcony and started screaming shit. Shades of Tia Maria. Very high drama. I said, Max, take it easy. We fought like truly mad people. We didn't even know what we were fighting about. We just fought. Then she picked up a knife.
I'm gonna cut you, motherfucker, she screamed. Go ahead, bitch.
You might say shit like that, but if you thought about it for a second, you'd know you don't mean it. She kind of lunged. I kind of danced into the blade with my left arm. There was a slight collision, but the knife was extremely sharp, sharp enough to cut through flesh with only the mildest of swipes. I saw red. Blood. My blood. I can't breathe. I don't remember how to breathe. Something's wrong. I'm gonna die. I don't even know where the fuck I am. Shit. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die. I rushed to the emergency room where the admissions nurse gave me one of those ho-hum looks, handed me a clipboard with forms attached, and asked me to sit down and fill them out.
With what? Blood? Look at my arm.
Here, use a pen. Finally, someone recognized me from TV and took care of me. I got a shot of something that numbed my arm. Then a doctor stitched me up. As he sewed, he asked me how I'd gotten the gash. I was trying out a knife trick, I said.
And so you stabbed yourself in the upper part of your arm?
He asked, not buying my explanation.
Yeah, I don't have it down yet.
Well, don't try it anymore. Please. For your own sake.
Okay, Doc. I won't.
I lived the kind of drama and tragedy that made for great comedy, but I let only bits and pieces creep into my act. Instinct told me to do more, except the pressure was to go with the flow.
Don't offend, Rich.
It was a politically charged time. Martin Luther King fought for equality and dignity. Malcolm clamored. But in terms of entertainment, white America wanted their black comedians colorless. Negro. Colored. Those were okay. But as comedy writer Murray Roman, a nice man who didn't know any better than to reflect prevailing opinion, advised me. Now, I'd introduce Bill to my mother. But a guy like you, don't mention the fact that you're a nigger. Don't go into such bad taste. Don't say, you can fuck white women, and if they don't come, they say,
it's all right. I'll just lay here for a while and use a vibrator.
Black women, they'll talk about you.
Nigga, well, is that it? Hell, you got to grind my pussy.
Oh, nigga, fuck me, shit. Don't put my legs down, motherfucker. The trouble was, I didn't know any better than to listen to Murray Roman and people like that. I didn't have a view of the big picture. I didn't know myself well enough. Charlie Chaplin had the little tramp, but I hadn't yet discovered my character. And that was because I tried so hard to be someone else. I didn't think about artistry as much as I did making monies. Monies. That was the goal, the dream. The more the better. I figured the more distance I put between me and poverty, the happier I'd be. Just tell jokes, Rich. Tell stories. Tell them like Bill would. And so my routine included harmless spoofs of life in the ghetto, such as when I pretended to be a doofus saying,
I heard a knock on the door. I said to my wife, there's a knock on the door. And my wife said, that's peculiar. We ain't got no door.
See, I didn't know any better. Like Cosby, I got a shot at playing Las Vegas. Bobby Darin, a fan of mine from the clubs, signed me as the opening act for his 3-week stint at the Flamingo Hotel. Bobby was cool. He could sing his ass off, and he was married to that pretty little girl Sandra Dee, and the $2,400 a week he offered to pay me was more monies than I'd ever made. Maxine went with me, and once I arrived in Sin City, I fell in love with the bright lights, party time atmosphere, and around-the-clock hustle of the Strip. Seeing my name on the Flamingo's marquee in the same air as Sinatra and Sammy was as big a thrill as I'd had up to that time. The shows were something else. I knew I wasn't as good as the review said I was, and I knew why. I just didn't want to say it. I didn't have to. One night, Don Rickles came backstage and praised my act.
It's uncanny, he said. You sound just like Bill Cosby.
Shit. Why'd he have to remind me? 13. In Los Angeles, Bobby Darin threw a party in my honor at a Shishi Beverly Hills restaurant. The place was so fancy, it made me nervous. I was even more uncomfortable being the center of attention, especially among all the famous people he'd invited. I sat across from Groucho Marx, who told me that he'd seen me on The Merv Griffin Show a few weeks earlier, when I had guested with Jerry Lewis. It hadn't been one of my better moments. Jerry and I had gotten laughs by spitting on each other, and Groucho, it turned out, had a few things to say about that.
Young man, you're a comic? He asked.
Yes, I nodded.
Yes, I am. So, how do you want to end up? Have you thought about that? Do you want a career you're proud of? Or do you want to end up a spitting wad like Jerry Lewis?
The man was right. I wondered how he knew I was so unsure of myself.
Huh? I mumbled. Do you ever see plays? He repeated. No, I answered. Do you ever read books? No. I could feel the stirrings of an identity crisis. It was coming on like the beginning of an acid trip. Groucho's comments spoke to me.
Wake up, Richard. Yes, you are an ignorant jerk, pimping your talent like a cheap whore. But you don't have to stay that way. You have a brain. Use it.
The thing was, I didn't have to. Sid Caesar eased me into movies. I met him at the Chateau Marmont Hotel in Hollywood. He interviewed me about being in The Busybody, a loopy cops and gangsters picture he was about to start filming. Having grown up watching Your Show of Shows, I was intimidated meeting Caesar, and also by having to keep up with his quick mind.
I can do German, he said. What about you?
I stared at him and said to myself, God damn. Sid Caesar's talking to me. But apparently I said something good. Outside the hotel, my agent said, You're going to play a detective. The movie zipped by before I learned what I was supposed to do. On the set, I met fellow comics Dom DeLuise, Jan Murray, and Godfrey Cambridge, but otherwise I tiptoed around the cameras, lights, and shit while asking myself, What the fuck am I doing here? As for acting, I faked it. Tried a little of this, a little of that, some Steve McQueen, some Humphrey Bogart. Bless my confused heart. But it was hard because I didn't have my own thing to do.
Why, Richard?
Why is that? Because I didn't know shit about myself. As soon as I finished, I went on a nightclub tour of the Midwest and dropped in on my family in Peoria in October. It was my first trip back home since leaving 5 years earlier. Nothing had changed. The places and people were the same.
Going home's nice. Some of the brothers still want to break my face. Nigga, you ain't shit. You wasn't shit when you were here. I seen you do that shit on TV. That's the same shit you were doing around the pool room. It ain't nothing.
Then a moment later, let me have a dollar. I fell into the old routines, playing cards, fishing, drinking, scooching whores, slipping in shit and getting laughs.
This will always be your home, baby, my grandma said.
Yet I'd changed, or so I thought. I'd seen more, seen possibilities, played for bigger pots. When I'd left town originally, nobody'd noticed. Now the Peoria Journal Star wrote a story about me coming back, and quoted my dad saying that my success had done the family proud and even brought a tear or two.
That was nice, Dad. How come we never talked like that in person?
Questions like that were probably what had brought me back home in the first place. Over the past 5 years, I'd become more successful than I'd ever imagined. I'd also forgotten who the person was who'd left Peoria. I'd lost my way when I decided to go for the Bucks. I had to rediscover Richard Pryor, the Richard Pryor whom club owner Harold Parker had allowed to pretend he could play the piano and tell jokes, and then described as having more nerve than anybody I'd ever seen. But how? By April 1967, Maxine was 9 months pregnant and due almost any time. She wanted a commitment from me, something I had no intention of giving her. I gambled. I stayed out all night at clubs. I could barely commit to being me. How could I give her more? But the more I said no, the more adamant she became. The only reason we stayed together was because neither of us had any other place to go. We were stuck, and it wasn't fun. One night, unable to stand the pressure any longer, I walked outside and stared up at the moon. It was like a big orange balloon, a big orange titty talking to me.
Hey, Rich, what's going on? Why don't you come and get me?
There was just something about it
air, the vibes, the moon, the way it beckoned. I said, damn, this moon's got something to do with me. So I went with it. I jumped in my car and followed the moon. I drove as if I was holding onto a rope, and when I finally let go, I was in Tijuana, Mexico. For the next few days, I rested, drank, and partied with several pretty little whores who showered me with loving attention. And for a while, had me forgetting Maxine. The guards at the border weren't as nice. On my way back into the United States, they pulled me over and searched my car. I didn't look guilty, but I was black, and I'm convinced that was the reason I got stopped. They searched me and said that they found an ounce of pot. Bullshit. There wasn't even enough to roll a joint. But they busted me anyway. So there I was, a black man going to jail for drugs as he tries crossing the U.S. border. Didn't look good for Richard. No, it didn't. I was fucking terrified for my life, you know? I was in jail in California. When they arrest you, they be serious. They'd look all in your asshole. You talk about degrading a nigga. That degrades you immediately. Take off your clothes. I didn't know what they be looking for. What you be looking for, man, in my ass? There ain't be nothing in my asshole. If I had a pussy, I might dig it. You can hide something in your pussy, but in my ass? What am I gonna hide in my asshole? A pistol? They threw me in a cell by myself, which was something of a relief. I laid down on the top bunk. Then they brought in another guy, another black man. Unlike me, however, this dude was big and scary. I don't want to accuse nobody of being guilty of anything before they had tried, but I knew from looking at him that the world was a little safer with him behind bars. But was I? Without saying a word to me, without even acknowledging me, he stripped off all his clothes and walked around buck naked. He reminded me of an angry bull, brooding, snorting, grinding. I feared what was going to happen when he caught sight of my skinny ass. I thought, Christ, I'm going to have to knock this motherfucker out. God, please give me the strength or else I'm probably going to have to get fucked. Eventually, he lay down on the bottom bunk and didn't bother me. I didn't say shit to the man either. Honest, I didn't even get off that top bunk. Not a peep from Rich. Many hours later, a deputy looked in the cell and asked with genuine surprise what I was doing there. Was he more ignorant than me? I was arrested, I said. Why are you still in here, though? He asked. Several possible responses came to mind before I said, they won't let me out. But you've got all this money. In the panic and confusion of getting arrested and going to jail, I'd forgotten there was $7,500 in my pocket. You can get your ass out of here, he continued. Well, let me out then, I said. After posting bail, I got in my car and drove home and found out my daughter Elizabeth had been born. Congratulations, Rich. But you didn't care, did you? Well, to be honest, not that much. You know, my attitude about kids and fatherhood was something stupid, something selfish, something that put all of them after my own momentary concerns. As she should have, Maxine resented me to the point where I was unable to take it anymore. I had a hard time thinking about anything but my own needs. No matter how much she screamed or fought with me, I simply wasn't going to change. It's nothing to be proud of. It's just the way it was. Finally, the day came when it was just all-out war between us, and I said, you know what? I could leave here. Maxine didn't argue. I remember that day. It was clear. As I left, I felt like I could see all the way to tomorrow and the next day. You know? 14. I don't remember how the summer of 1967 was for the rest of the country, but my ass landed at the Sunset Tower Motel in Hollywood, home for a hodgepodge of Hollywood dreamers, schemers, and hustlers. For about $100 a month, I not only got a place to sleep, but also an interesting social life. For starters, the girl I dated lived there. Brandy worked as a phone operator, but moonlighted as a dancer at the Whiskey A Go-Go. Another dancer friend of hers, Carol, also lived in the tower. The first time Brandy took me to Carol's apartment, I walked in and saw another guy in there. I said the first thing that came to mind, "Let's take off our clothes and have an orgy." How was I supposed to know the other guy was Carol's brother? Paul Mooney, a large black man who loved to talk and talk and talk, would become a comedian, my lifelong friend, collaborator, comic foil, alter ego, antagonist, and so on. But as soon as Mooney heard me suggest having a sex party, he exploded. He threw my ass out in the hall. "Get the fuck out, nigga," he said, as the door closed behind me. Mooney and I began seeing each other at comedy clubs, and we became friends anyway. He was fascinated by me. He always said he'd never known anyone who didn't give a shit about rules or propriety, someone who didn't care about anything except what he wanted at the moment. That was me, especially once I discovered instant gratification through a drug dealer I called Dirty Dick. He was a funny-looking black dude who talked in bullshit rhymes, handled top-of-the-line cocaine. I used the motherfucker as if he was an automatic teller machine, snorting up $100 to $200 a day, and I didn't even realize how much I liked to snort coke. After one night with Dick, I came home fairly well fucked up. Not a great idea in the building where I live, because it was a strange place if you weren't careful. For instance, the elevator had a mind of its own. If you pushed 3, you ended up in the basement. If you pushed basement, you were fucked. So while I was attempting to navigate a path to my apartment, something happened between me and the motherfucker working the late shift at the front desk. I don't know what, but it was loud and nasty.
"You can't say that crap to me," he said.
"If I want, I can say it to you and your mama," I snapped. In a blur, this motherfucker turned into Bruce Lee with a bad attitude. He snapped his shoes off, crouched in a karate stance, started waving his fists, and snarled, "Come on, nigga. Come on and try it." I thought the motherfucker was funny. He moved way too much to know something. Police records indicated that I hit the motherfucker in the face and broke his glasses. I don't remember shit about that. But then the cops arrived, only I didn't know they were cops, and when they slapped some handcuffs on me, I thought something strange was going down. I thought maybe I might be going for a swim with the fishies. Held in front of the hotel, I shouted toward the building and passing cars, "Hey, y'all help me! They're taking me someplace! Help me!" I was high crazy. I went to jail. Then the fucker sued and won $75,000. What could I do? I just said, fuck it. Then Maxine sued me for child support and assorted bullshit. She claimed that we'd live together like husband and wife. I didn't contest it, and the court sided with her. I tried to avoid the mess by shuffling from one club to the next. In a way, I used that to my advantage. I saw myself as a victim of the system, an outsider for whom justice was out of reach, a dream. And then I saw how closely my situation mirrored the black man's larger struggle for dignity and equality and justice in white society. That was me. I was that character. That was the person to whom I had to give voice. I decided to drop out of the whole damn thing altogether. Got rid of my driver's license. Quit carrying identification of any kind. Stop using banks, paying traffic tickets, income taxes, and all that shit. Why not? I couldn't win. It didn't seem as if any of us could win. I saw the judge give one nigga 40 years. He said,
"That's right, fella. 40 years. You want more time, buddy?"
Dude had a court-appointed lawyer, right? Copping a plea. "Your Honor, this man is not a heroin dealer per se. He's being manipulated by these people. He was merely trying to get enough monies together to help his dear mom. She had a spinal condition. She needed an operation, and she didn't have the funds to do this. He was merely trying to raise the money. He tried every job he could, and he couldn't have raised the money. When the officers caught him with the 280 kilos, he was trying to purchase a hospital in the Bahamas." Judge said,
"Motion denied."
Nigga was so fucked up when they laid him away, he said, "Thank you, Your Honor." At our last meeting, my agent sounded like one of my grandmother's whores singing to a John. "You're great, baby. Oh, you're the best. No one else like you, baby." The money was getting bigger. Checks piled up around my place like litter on the highway. I didn't have to worry about work. My agent booked me at the Aladdin in Las Vegas. It was a big deal. I was nonplussed. In fact, as we shook hands, I had the feeling that I was making a pact with someone who just wanted to suck my blood. "Hey, man. Say, nigga, you with the cape. What you doing peeking in them people's window? What's your name, boy?"
"Dracula."
"What kind of name is that for a nigga? Where you from, fool?"
"Transylvania."
"I know where that is, nigga. Yeah. You ain't the smartest motherfucker in the world, you know. Even though you is the ugliest. Oh, yeah. Why don't you get your teeth fixed, nigga?" I couldn't explain the transformation taking place. I don't understand it myself. I only know my days of pretending to be as slick and colorless as Cosby were numbered. There was a world of junkies and winos, pool hustlers and prostitutes, women and families screaming inside my head, trying to be heard. The longer I kept them bottled up, the harder they tried to escape. The pressure built till I went nuts. "Better get home before the sun come up. See your ass in the day. You're liable to get arrested." The time I rolled into Vegas in September, I was completely fucked up. Okay on the outside, but I felt as if my legs were going to give out any minute. I was sandwiched between the headliner, Pat the Hip Hypnotist Collins, and the Brasilia Jazz Review. Or so people have told me, because I don't remember shit. Only that it was opening night. "Now, please welcome a very funny gentleman. You've seen him on a number of TV shows, Mr. Richard Pryor." I came out. Nice applause. I looked out at the audience. The first person I saw was Dean Martin, seated at one of the front tables. He was staring right back at me. At me. I asked myself, "Who's he looking at, Rich?" I checked out the rest of the audience. They were staring at me as intently as Dean, waiting for that first laugh. Again, I asked myself, "Who are they looking at, Rich?" I didn't know. I couldn't say, "They're looking at you, Richard," because I didn't know who Richard Pryor was. And in that flash of introspection, when I was unable to find an answer, I crashed. I had a nervous breakdown. I looked back at Dean, who was still looking at me, waiting for something, you know? "You want to suck what? Nigga, are you some kind of prevert? An ugly prevert?"
You ain't sucking nothing here, Junior. You want to suck some blood? Go down to the blood bank, nigga. Hope you get sickle cell.
I imagined what I looked like and got disgusted. I gasped for clarity as if it was oxygen. The fog rolled in. In a burst of inspiration, I finally spoke to the sold-out crowd. What the fuck am I doing here? Then I turned and walked off the stage. God was much funnier than me that night. Instead of guiding me off stage to my dressing room, he pointed me in the wrong direction. I found myself standing on a narrow ledge between the curtain. I couldn't turn around. Nor would I. So in my tux, I inched and clawed my way along the tiny lip of wood toward the faint glow of an exit sign, scraping my nose until it bled and muttering, "Fuck, fuck, fuck." Backstage, I gathered my clothes and left the hotel, climbing into my 65 Mustang, and drove to L.A. My agent was hysterical, incredulous. How could I have walked off? What the fuck was going on? "Do you know what you did?" my agent screamed. "Do you know what this means?"
"No, you're the agent. You tell me."
Then I heard those famous words.
"You'll never work in this town again. Did you hear me? You will never work in this town again."
I have a thing for nudity. I always like to get naked. I did that in Vegas. Got naked and ran through the casino nude. Jumped up on the table and said, "Blackjack!" I can still hear him saying that. "You will never work in this town again." 15. Contrary to rumor, my Las Vegas flameout wasn't in front of a mafia audience. It didn't cause the mob to put out a contract on me, lead to a ban from ever performing at the hotels, or serve as my ticket to the loony bin. The only fact was the inevitability. The breakdown was the only way I could shed the phony image I'd created and start rebuilding my self-respect. I was a Negro for 23 years. I gave that shit up. No room for advancement. In the weeks after, I continued to hear the threat, "You'll never work in this town again." So, it would have been a different story if my agent had said, "You'll never fuck in this town again." Then I would have listened. As it happened, after returning to L.A., I fell hard in love with Shelley Bonas, a rich hippie girl who would become my second wife. We met at a nightclub. Shelley noticed me looking at her, strolled over to where I sat, and then kicked up her leg as if finishing a dance step. That was so goddamn cute. I was hooked immediately. There's nothing better or more exciting than falling in love, and if I do say so, I do it well. However, it's like jumping in a pool when you don't know how to swim. I hear myself screaming, "Edge, Rich, get to the edge!" So it was with Shelley. We didn't waste any time getting together. She moved into my rustic cabin-like place above Laurel Canyon, and we fell passionately, madly, silly in love. She walked around barefoot, wore love beads, lighted incense, new things, and at a time when I was struggling, she made me feel free. Her simplicity was charming. We could do absolutely nothing and be happy. We used to walk around picking up rocks and giving them names. We kissed them. We gave them to each other as presents. Stupid shit that made us laugh. Then we got married. Really fun, man. All those funny things we used to do together. I'd bring her a rock. She'd go, "Oh, a rock for me?" She got me to marry her while I was bawling and I was coming. "Will you marry me?" "Yes, yeah, oh, yeah." At the end of December, my dad called with bad news. My stepmother, Viola, had died. I told him I was sorry and hoped that was enough. But he wanted me at the funeral.
Dad, I ain't going.